Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We seem to talk about Brooklyn a lot on the show, don't we? It's not just that I'm a Brooklyn boy and I'm here to represent for my home borough. It's that so many bands are based there now, and it's been the epicenter of the indie rock scene for over a decade. But Brooklyn is a lot more than indie rock, and there's one long-standing Brooklyn band that aims to prove that point, just not in the way you might expect. Listen to this.
You can watch them scowl, feel them prowl, wild and steady sizing every inch about you. Fast math measuring what you amount to. The laughter, the screams, the number roll, the song of songs, the book of dreams. Ends don't meet where the arms can't reach. Mean streets, even when it's free, it ain't cheap.
That is the Brooklyn Philharmonic, conducted by Alan Pearson, and featuring last season's artist in residence, the rapper Mos Def. We recorded them at a concert series I produced at the World Financial Center. This season, the Brooklyn Phil has made another inspired but unexpected choice for their new artist in residence. We'll meet Erykah Badu in just a moment. We met Alex Winter many years ago. Remember Alex? He was Bill in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Excellent!
Well, Alex Winter has grown up to be a serious filmmaker, and we'll talk to him about Downloaded, his engaging documentary about the music file-sharing site Napster. And we'll share some live music with you, completely free but completely legal, when the band Yellowbirds, yes, they're from Brooklyn, troops into our studio. But first...
Well, I escaped this vanity.
Erykah Badu already has a title. People have called her the Queen of Neo-Soul for years. But now, she has another title, Artist in Residence with the Brooklyn Philharmonic. This weekend in New York, the Brooklyn Phil, conductor Alan Pearson, and singer-songwriter Erykah Badu unveil new orchestral versions of some of her songs. On Wednesday morning, they were all at the Demena Center, a rehearsal space in Midtown Manhattan. And we were there, too, to listen in and to speak a bit with Erykah Badu. Erykah, first of all, thank you for spending some time with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you.
You are artist in residence with the Brooklyn Philharmonic.
Yeah.
What has that experience been like for you?
Well, this is my first day. It feels really comfy. You know, I'm pretty mutable when it comes to music, especially with a frequency that is familiar to me. Mm-hmm. So I just love it.
We recently had the actor John Malkovich on the show, and he's been doing some stuff with an orchestra, too. And he said nothing in his career prepared him for the experience of being in the middle of an orchestra and experiencing that sound.
Yeah.
Now, you've obviously had a lot more direct experience in music, but still, has this been a different experience for you?
It has. It's floating and having a chance to hear this body of work done in a totally different remixed way. It's really cool. The different movements that we go through are kind of what I was, the process or the route that my mind was taking almost.
Well, now that's interesting because most of the songs, I think all of the songs that you're doing with the Brooklyn Phil come from the New America Part 1.
Right.
Which seemed to be, I mean, that album was kind of a piece.
Yeah.
You know, both in terms of the kind of ideas behind it and the way the songs flowed into each other. It was almost as if you were thinking on a
big canvas when you wrote those songs.
Yeah, there's with this piece, it's part of a two-piece duo, a New America Part 1 and 2. Part 1 is that we're doing is a little bit more social, analytical,
right,
politically, you know, speaking. And the second one is a little more right-brained, emotional. So I would call this my left brain part. And it's kind of me standing on an apex, looking around, shifting from one part of the world to the other, comparing what we are all going through,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And with the Brooklyn Phil, I mean, you know, they're kind of making a social statement with what they've been doing,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of reaching out to the various communities in Brooklyn. And
mm-hmm.
I produced a concert with Mos Def and the Brooklyn Phil
yeah.
last season at mm-hmm. the World Financial Center. And looking out at that audience,
mm-hmm.
it was an orchestra manager's dream. They were young. They were diverse. They were loud.
Yeah.
They were active. So maybe not every orchestra manager's dream, but, you know. Now, you have kids.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is it important to you to think that they could grow up with, you know, an orchestra as part of their... as something
listening?
That's, yeah, part of their community and not something old and other.
Yeah. I think that it's important for them to visit many layers of art and music. This particular combination of my music, which is, I guess, funk and soul and hip-hop, and classical, it's... I don't know, it's a marriage that seems like it's supposed to be there. It's always been there. And it's just been waiting for us to, I guess, join together,
mm-hmm.
consummate it. You know, it's, and I think out of this will come little babies, little different subcultures of music and things, you know.
Erica Badu at the Demena Center in New York. Her first rehearsal with the Brooklyn Philharmonic. She's their artist in residence this season.
Hearing the songs in this way,
mm-hmm.
have you found layers in the songs that you didn't know were there through these orchestrations?
Yeah, things that I couldn't express while I was composing the piece. Yeah, my thinking process is very, very similar to some of the sequences and breaks in mm-hmm. each song. You know, you a lot comes out sometimes when you're writing, and then just little bitty things. And then some burst of great creativity. So that's what it kind of sounds like with the timpanis and the I have a studio audience in my head all the time,
mm-hmm.
laughing at the stuff I'm saying and booing too. So this may add another layer because I kind of hear strings in the background now as I'm moving through time.
There's a line early in the New America Part 1 where you describe yourself as an analog girl in a digital world.
Right.
And here you are surrounded by like the ultimate analog
experience.
Yeah,
yeah, it's beautiful.
Erica Badu rehearsing her song, Me, with the Brooklyn Philharmonic.
So since you're now working with an orchestra as an artist in residence with the Brooklyn Phil, let me ask you a kind of composer question.
Sure.
You know, there are some composers who start with the form, I'm going to write a symphony, and then mm-hmm. they fill in the content.
Sure.
And then there are others who just start with the idea mm-hmm. and then follow it and then see what it is that they've made.
Yeah.
Which of those, how do you approach songwriting?
I think both ways for me, but more of the latter, more of throwing a big piece of clay on the table, carving away intuitively, and a piece is left on the table for mm-hmm. you. You know, just kind of carving away, feeling your way through it.
Now, how closely have you worked with Ted Hearn, the composer, on the orchestrations of your songs?
Ted and I, he came to Dallas to my home. He flew there, and we talked and chose songs and went through photographs and pieces of art, and I don't know, just kind of got in bed with it and tossed around lots of ideas. And this is the next time I've seen him, and this is the result of it. It's more than I expected and thought.
Yeah.
And it's funky. I didn't know white people could. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Well,
people with straighter hair. I mean.
The Brooklyn Phil has shown in
well, because this is Brooklyn.
Right.
Okay, I take that back.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Dallas. You split your time between Dallas and Brooklyn, right?
I do. For the most part, I'm in Dallas. Mm-hmm. But I have an apartment here in Brooklyn that is kind of like my museum or hangout sanctuary. I go there to write and to pray and to be and to kind of regroup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what are you hoping at the, you know, when they came to you and said, would you be our artist in residence? What were you sort of hoping to get out of this?
Money. Some money. Pay my bills. Uh-huh. But, no, seriously, I was just hoping to learn and enjoy the experience. It's a whirlwind. I'm in the middle of or the eye of this beautiful storm right now. Mm-hmm. Looking around and learning and a little out of my element because I don't read music. And even as a composer, you know, you kind of can catch on. And the sheet music was put in front of me and I could follow it and understand it. And I thought I really couldn't understand the language. Mm. So this experience has given me confidence in this area and wings in this area.
Yeah. You know? Had you ever listened to classical music, orchestral music as a kid growing up?
Absolutely. Yeah. All the time.
Who were your favorites?
The basics, you know, Food, Clothing, and Shelter, Beethoven, Bach, all of them.
The sound was not unexpected, but still, to stand there today for the first time and have it envelop you, what was that like?
Oh, I felt like I was Curtis Mayfield or Stevie Wonder or someone in an analog experience that was able to actually manifest what was in their mind. You know, when we're writing, I do hear strings and sweeping choruses and timpanis and clarinets and bass saxophones and things. We don't always have access to all of that stuff.
Right.
And you don't even know that's what you're hearing. But once it's out, you know, in the atmosphere and the frequency there, you can only say that was it. That's mm-hmm. it. That's what I wanted to hear. That's what was meant to be.
You know, that wasn't a record, it was a mistake. I was like, bitch, I cut that, it was something else happening. And it's great.
It was a fun moment during Erica Badu's rehearsal with the Brooklyn Philharmonic when we find that what was meant to be, as Erica was telling us a moment ago, isn't always what you originally intend. This part of rehearsal moved on to Erica Badu's Master Teacher Part 2. So the New America Part 2 is already 3 years ago. Is there a new record in the works?
Yeah, it's going to come out at some point in time, I'm sure. You know, as a writer, there's always this downloading period, which some people call writer's block. You know, which is really to me kind of a period to be learned, to learn and to grow and to become, you know, so that you have something to write about or something to say.
You actually made something of your writer's block some years ago.
I did.
Doing a whole sort of tour named after it.
Right. It was called the Frustrated Artist Tour. And at that point, I was able to have a tour bus dedicated to recording, where ideas would come from the night on stage, and we would go straight to the bus and start recording things. And the Frustrated Artist Tour birthed an album called Worldwide Underground. And different friends all over the place, all over the circuit I was traveling, would hop on the bus. Lynn Kravitz, Queen Latifah, Angie Stone.
Questo.
Yeah, Questlove, of course. James Poyser, Dilla, many, many people.
So, new record later this year, and whether this residency ends up shaping some of those songs, I guess too soon to say?
Not too soon, because I'm so super excited. I have a million ideas. I've already written a record between walking from the rehearsal to right here. You know, I got so many ideas just from sitting in the room with the musicians.
Erykah Badu, it's a great start to your residency with the Brooklyn Phil. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We recorded Erykah Badu and a bit of her rehearsal with the Brooklyn Phil on Wednesday at the Domena Center in Manhattan. The concerts are Saturday and Sunday at BAM. Saturday is already sold out. Up next, live music, properly recorded this time, right here in our studio. It's the psych pop band Yellowbirds, next on Soundcheck. Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. The Brooklyn psych pop band Yellowbirds makes a joyful noise. They were last in our studio with their 2011 debut called The Color. Now they're back with another colorful album. It's called Songs from the Vanished Frontier. One of those songs is For Girls Who Love to Sing, and the band is going to start us off with a live performance of that. It's Yellowbirds, live on Soundcheck.
Two, three, four.
Gentlemen, falling at your feet, you break their hearts and let them taste defeat. How could you love a boy like? How could you love a boy like me? You're just too pretty. Line along a lonely street. great when I get like that. Would she even stay? I remember him, the boy in the bright red crown, making all the pretties laugh by putting everybody down. How could you love a boy?
Is the band Yellowbirds live on Soundcheck with a song called For Girls Who Love to Sing. You'll find a version of it on the new album by Yellowbirds called Songs from the Vanished Frontier. Sam Cohen doing lead vocals and playing guitar, Annie Nero on bass and backing vocals, Brian Cantor behind the drums and backing vocals, Josh Kaufman playing electric guitar as well. Sam Cohen, good to see you again.
Good to see you again, John.
2 years ago, when you were here with the first Yellowbirds album, it was kind of a transitional phase, it seemed, in your career, from solo to band. Now you're back basically with the same crew, so the lineup has kind of, you know,
congealed.
Solidified.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say congealed.
Oh, we hate
congealed
that word.
Congealed is a disgusting
overused
word.
Oh, yeah, gloppy, fatty stuff.
But it's sort of firmed up and has become, you know, a thing. So has the process of making the music kind of changed over the last 2 years as well?
I think it's still relatively the same. I mean, I still sort of, this project started sort of as me branching off from Apollo Sunshine, which is more of a collective. This was sort of a chance for me to be the songwriter, mm-hmm. kind of oversee things and do what I want to do. And it still sort of is that, but now I have these amazing friends and musicians with me who are kind of on the same page. We're doing it together. So yeah, it's definitely an exciting time, and I feel lucky to have these guys. Playing shows is a ton of fun because mm-hmm. we get along really well, and it's just a great crew.
Good thing then that you have lots of shows coming up. Wednesday Night Residency, every Wednesday in the month of June here in New York at Rockwood, 10 p.m. The album, the title, Songs from the Vanished Frontier, and song titles like What's Out There and Young Men of Promise, you know, it just seems to have a very kind of old American flavor to it, you know, maybe looking west at great expanses. Was that intentional, or was that an accident?
No, absolutely. I think sort of a running theme is something I think about when I'm writing and just think about in general, is we've sort of reached this point in culture where it's really hard to see where the openings are for expansion, you know, either creatively or how capitalism could get any more out of control. Like, where are we going to fit more billboards? I mean, there's all sorts of frontiers that seem to be completely eaten up.
Yeah.
There are still musical frontiers, though. Where they are is anybody's guess, but it's, you know, in the world of digital music, there are constantly new things developing. So when someone does take time to kind of look back the way you do on this record, it's, you know, it's kind of striking. And the first thing that struck me listening to the record was the opening of the album, where you actually quote from Maurice Ravel, the early 20th century French composer, some of his Daphnis and Chloe suite. What did that signify for you, using that music?
It's just something that struck me as... It just had the mood that I wanted to convey with this record.
Well, the particular excerpt you chose is The Sunrise, which is like the grand conclusion of the Daphnis and Chloe suite. And it's this like grand kind of musical statement, and not an inappropriate thing to open a record with, I guess. Let me play for you what I'm talking about here with Sam Cohen. From the album Yellowbirds, this is the opening moment from the record on a song called Stop Tonight. Not bad having Ravel as your opening act there, setting the scene for you. Sam Cohen and the band Yellowbirds, that's the opening of Stop Tonight, which is the opening track on the new record, Songs from the Vanished Frontier. Are you a classical music fan in general?
I definitely can't converse about it in any kind of way that would be impressive. I have some records and I like to listen to them. I don't know the names of anything.
Was that actually a recording, or was that, you know, done in the studio, sort of recreating?
That's a sample from my record collection.
All right. Now, in addition to the audio part of this, there's also the visual part, the cover art, sort of, you know, vintage photos. So again, in keeping with what we were talking about a moment ago, and then there are the videos, two of which people can see on our website at soundcheck.org. You did some stop motion videos for the last album as well.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about, you know, the videos, the visual experience that is important to you?
I think that it's just another way to communicate. You know, I see whole worlds and colors and fourth dimensional spaces when I work on this music, and the best moments of when I listen back to it. I think any kind of clues you can give listeners, any reason to latch on, any other associations they can take away from your music, it's a worthwhile thing to put out there.
Well, with the song The Ceiling, the association is suddenly underground in a coral reef, underwater rather, and, you know, swimming through a coral reef, which is not an association I would have made just listening to the song, but it's a really neat video. The first album that Yellowbirds did was called The Color, so that whole sense of, you know, aligning color with music. Do you see colors when you hear particular chords or notes or anything like that?
I do. I don't really have a system of, like, this chord is always that. But, yeah, I just sort of see splashes and just a lot of abstract stuff when I listen to music.
We're speaking with Sam Cohen and listening to the band Yellowbirds. They're performing for us here in the Soundcheck studio, and performing every Wednesday for the month of June at the Rockwood Music Hall, 10 p.m. Let's hear another live performance from the band Yellowbirds, Young Men of Promise. And this is one of those songs for which a video has been made. And you can find that video on our website, soundcheck.org. But let's hear it played live by Yellowbirds here in the Soundcheck studio.
Like a car crash on a river, you're a raging sea. Promise can only keep promising for so long. Dragging stacks of mighty speakers from one ocean to another shore. Promise can only promising for so long, rewriting with our destination, pale riders on the road, like coals in a furnace wide open, covered in snow. Drag the stacks of mighty speakers from one ocean to another shore. Promise can only keep promising for so long.
That is Yellowbirds, live on Soundcheck with Young Men of Promise, a song from their new record called Songs from the Vanished Frontier. Sam Cohen singing and playing guitar, Annie Nero on bass, Josh Kaufman on guitar, Brian Cantor on drums, all of them providing backing vocals at various times as well. That sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, there were grins aplenty at the end of that song.
We like each other. We like playing together.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
And you're doing this residency Wednesday evenings, every Wednesday for the month of June at Rockwood Music Hall. What's the plan for those shows? Do you do the same set every week?
No, we'll be mixing it up a lot every week. And each week we're playing with good friends of ours. We play at 10, friends play at 11. So this show tomorrow night's with Alicia Shakur, who I play with, and we've been playing together for years. She's amazing. Next week we're going to do our new record From Cover to Cover. And we'll be throwing in different covers at the shows and doing different different things to mix it up.
Now, who might Yellowbirds be covering in the course of a given night?
We might cover the Walker Brothers at some point in this residency.
Okay. So going back to the kind of surreal 60s sound, although, before Scott Walker was Scott Walker, when he was just one of the Walker brothers, they were really more pop than the kind of dark psychedelia that he later went
There's
into.
There's a couple of tracks, though, that are really sweet sounding.
Yeah. Okay.
Some of it gets way too campy for me, but they've got a few that are really just so good.
Now, that's music from before you were around. So
yeah, well before.
Yeah. So how did you... You know, do you listen to a lot of music from the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I think most of the music I listen to is from the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Really?
Yeah.
And how did you get into that?
I don't know. It just sort of kept digging backwards. You know, I started playing music because I idolized Guns N' Roses, and my friends and I decided on the playground to start a band exactly like that. And then so we started figuring out...
Were you going to be Axl?
I was going to be Slash.
You were going to be Slash?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
So, you know, you start digging backwards, be like, how'd he get so good? Who'd he listen to? Oh, Jimi Hendrix. Oh, who'd he listen to? And you just keep going backwards, you know.
Mm. So where do you stop?
I guess I stopped kind of when the electric guitar got invented. I listened to some stuff before that, but not a lot.
Well, there's been plenty of electric guitar here in the studio today. The album is called Songs from the Vanished Frontier. The band is Yellowbirds. And Sam, to you and the rest of the gang, good to see you again. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having us.
The actor Alex Winter appeared in films like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and The Lost Boys. But his latest project is directing a documentary about Napster. We'll hear all about it next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. With all the fanfare right now over Google's new music service and the rise of Spotify and a new online radio service from Apple, it's easy to forget about Napster. A little more than a decade ago, four online friends launched a file-sharing service. And in doing so, they created millions of loyal fans and angered several very large record companies, and sparked the beginning of the end of the old music business. That's the story chronicled in the new documentary Downloaded, which opens in New York on June 21st. Downloaded was directed by Alex Winter. You might know him as half of the duo Bill and Ted from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. He joined us just before the film premiered at South by Southwest and talked about how he first connected with Napster back in the 90s.
I was a big proponent of Napster, not from the sort of ethic piracy fight thing, but just as a very tech-interested layman. I'd been searching around for internet communities since the early to mid-90s, BBS's newsgroups, things like that. And suddenly overnight, there was this radical evolution. It was almost unthinkable, the difference between the world before and after Napster in terms of music and global internet community.
Now, it's interesting you use the words internet community, because when people think of Napster, they think of one thing: file sharing, piracy, music piracy, run rampant on the internet. What we find out is that the four guys who essentially start Napster started around music, but started as an internet community.
Absolutely. Yeah, music was really a delivery system for them. Their end game, the vision that Sean Fanning had when something popped into his head when he was 18 years old, was a global community. It wasn't file sharing. And he set out to code something that would bring people together. And he thought, what will bring them together? Music. And of course, he was a lover of music. And so that created a second prop. First, I've got to create a global internet community where no one's done one before. And then I've got to create a way to move music files around the internet, which no one's ever been able to do successfully before. And he did both. It's kind of extraordinary. Whether you love him or hate him, it was an extraordinary feat.
Mm-hmm. So of the four guys, Sean Fanning is the one who really creates what comes to be known as Napster.
Yes.
And he is obviously one of the main people that you talk to here. Downloaded is the name of the film. Alex Winter, the actor and the director behind this documentary about Napster. So no sooner do people sort of come to grips with what the internet is or can be than this thing happens that nobody is prepared for, perhaps least of all, the four guys who started Napster.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, this really was, I kind of look at now, I mean, maybe every youth revolt is this way. You maybe could say the same thing about the Beatles, not that I completely, contextually relate mm-hmm. these two. But, this certainly has been a youth revolt. And there was what struck me that was interesting about telling these guys' story, even when I first got involved in it, was the crazy disparity between their brilliance and their naivete. I mean, it was shocking, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's lovely in a way because that's how things get done. But that's, it did throw a boulder in the water that there's absolutely no way they were prepared for.
There's a moment in the film Downloaded where Napster co-founder Sean Parker talks about those early days of the company.
It was one of the first times in history where you had this sort of pure youth revolution. Young, inexperienced, relatively unsophisticated but smart kids could create something entirely out of nowhere and revolutionize an industry that they frankly knew nothing about and had no relationships in. And this all happened, I think it probably 6 months passed before we ever had a conversation with anyone from the music industry. And it wasn't because we didn't want to have a conversation with anyone in the music industry. We just didn't know anyone in the music industry.
That's great. That is Sean Parker, who along with Sean Fanning and Ali Idar and Jordan Ritter are the four guys who started Napster, the notorious file-swapping music site, started in 1998. And 98 is really when, I mean, they, as this Sean says, they really were sort of feeling their way.
Absolutely.
At the time.
Yeah.
Why was the early internet, the internet 1.0, the 90s version, the perfect place, the perfect spot for a revolution like this?
I think it's exactly what you just said. I think that there were a lot of kids online. There were a lot of tech interested punters like myself online. But most people in the status quo, or sort of the established business paradigms, had no interest or awareness or understanding of the internet whatsoever. It was very clunky, very slow. For people like myself, it was an amazing place to inhabit. So basically, the back door got left open. And the power of the internet, which we're just really seeing, I think, today, in terms of, looking at CISPA and some of the other issues that are going on today, and the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act and all that.
Thank you.
I'll try not to descend into geek speak. These issues are real. And, you know, I think that now the slumbering giant has woken up and gone, oh, this isn't just about music sharing. This isn't just about global community like Facebook. This is about some pretty significant issues, and the internet is very powerful in a number of ways. We better start waking up and taking some action. And there are various forms of action, some good, some bad, that are being taken. But it's taken a very long time for people to catch up to the power of the internet. For those of us that got on it in the mid-90s, I think we were aware then and there that it had that kind of power.
Well, these four guys who start Napster meet on an IRC, an internet relay chat. And you'll need to explain what that is, I think, for people who are not teenagers in the mid-90s.
The IRC was one of several sort of core areas on the internet, communities on the internet, for lack of a better word. There are still some communities. IRC still exists. 4chan. There are still communities that are very reserved for hardcore net people that can really hack their way into anything. And again, that's, you know, hackers' terms has become sort of criminalized, but hacker was always a sort of a point of respect amongst the community of computer users all the way back to the
60s. It suggested you could write code.
Exactly. And yeah. Yeah. It was sort of, you know, your ability to fraternize anywhere in cyberspace. So, you know, that's where you could. And people like Fanning and Parker were able to really – they actually gained reputations in that space by the time they were 15, 16 years old that were formidable reputations.
And Sean Fanning's handle, his online handle, was Napster.
It was, yeah, yeah.
So it's very funny. There's a funny moment in the film Downloaded where one of the other guys – maybe it's Parker or one of the other founders – talks about Sean Fanning, you know, trying to get the music – sharing code to work, and he's asking them for advice, and they're saying, well, let's see the code. And he's like, nope, not going to show you the code.
Yeah, he was very proprietary of the source code. You know, I think he felt, you know, this was his idea. It was his lightning in a bottle moment, and he wanted to protect it.
Yeah. Now, there is a moment where two of the key players talk about their aha moment, their thunderbolt out of the blue, the realization of what you were just talking about, Alex, the possibilities of the internet with music. First, you'll hear Ian Rogers, who is now the CEO of Topspin Media, and then you'll hear Napster creator Sean Fanning.
You know, 1998 was when it really felt like, okay, this is real. This is the way I'm going to listen to music. It became clear that the computer was going to be the place that we would store our music. Then you started looking for tools to get the music into the computer, tools to play it back, tools to manage it.
I remember the first MP3 I ever downloaded, and I remember the first time I ever, you know, basically ever played a track from the internet. And I remember just thinking, even though it's just information, it's just audio, there's such a crazy amount of emotion. The fact that you could kind of share emotion over the internet, it was really wild to think that something so important to you, you could just trade so freely. So I think it was, it's hard to quantify how important it was.
From the documentary Downloaded about Napster, that's, you heard the voice of Napster founder Sean Fanning, and before that, Ian Rogers. We're speaking with Alex Winter, the director behind the new documentary, which premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin. And so it's 1998, they start Napster. How big, how fast?
It's become this sort of Rashomon story, which is part of the fun of the doc, is everyone's got a different perspective on the past, however recent it may have been. You know, having been around Fanning, I was always amazed that, you know, he put it online and it exploded immediately amongst his community.
Uh-huh.
Everybody immediately, people like Ian Rogers, even at that time, pricked up their ears immediately and were like, this is watershed. This is 180 degrees inverted from where we've been up until this moment. You know, as Ali talks about in the movie, I think it took another year for the rest of the world to catch up. But as we said, I think in the clip you even played, you know, that was still those guys working on code. They got it to go from 30,000 users to 20 million, I think, within a few weeks.
Wow.
So it gives you a really – I mean, this is in the age of dial-up. This is not a broadband era.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's the that kind of scale is almost impossible to comprehend today.
So 20 million users at a time when AOL had like 23 million
exactly.
users.
And they surpassed AOL within that month.
So we're talking about something that, you know, was in a kind of legal gray area. I mean, as far as the Napster guys were concerned, all they were doing was allowing people to share stuff that was on their computers.
Right.
Napster was not, I mean, they make this point, and you make the point in the film, they were not, you know, burning CDs and then distributing them. They were simply putting people in touch with other people and allowing them to share.
Yes.
That was not the safe harbor that they thought it would be. And, of course, one of your other jobs as the director of this movie is to go to the other side. And you spoke to everybody, it seems. I mean, all the Napster dudes, all the honchos at the record labels and stuff. What kind of reaction, how soon was it before the industry sort of looked over its shoulder and said, what the hell is that?
It took surprisingly long. You know, I think that the technology is still something that a lot of people from non-tech-oriented industries don't understand. I think some of the legislation we've seen when it has been, you know, shot down is often just because it's the way it's written doesn't even comprehend how these decentralized file systems work. It wouldn't actually do anything to prevent anything. I think there's still a lot of ignorance in terms of how these technologies work. It took a long time for the labels to wake up and realize quite how big the genie was and quite how big the bottle was that it got out of.
So, you know, you had – we get to relive the sight of musicians like Alanis Morissette at congressional hearings and stuff, basically, you know, talking the company line about piracy and stuff like that. There's also – you speak with Don Einar. He's the former chairman of the Sony Music Label Group and Columbia Records. So he's one of the biggies. And here is his recollection of how the industry first began to respond to Napster.
The five global heads of the companies at the time most likely couldn't agree that today was Wednesday. And for different reasons. People had different ideas. People had different visions. And no one was used to this. And the word ambush happened a lot of times in the conversations that we have with everybody. The record business was kind of ambushed, however we want to look at it. And you got to deal with an ambush. You dealt with Pearl Harbor, you got to deal with it, right?
Wow. So he was not a happy camper.
No, I mean, you know, to
he
have
was
your...
ready to go to war.
Yes.
And he did.
They did, yes. They did, yeah. Yeah.
So the lawsuit follows. There's one point where the Napster guys, you have this great footage of them from 98, 99, and then, of course, you've talked to them since then. In retrospect, they look back at that case and they think, wow, we really hired the wrong lawyer.
Yeah, I think that for them, you know, as you said, they really believed that they were doing something that fit under the umbrella, the safe harbor of, you know, the same thing Google does, which is just moving information around. Whether or not that's the case, it never got to the Supreme Court. The thing about Napster people don't know, it never went to trial, ever. They never had a trial. They had plenty of these sort of preliminary hearings, mm-hmm. and it died there. So we never got to, you know, they never got to determine. They may have lost. You know, it might have been decided, no, you don't have safe harbor. That's illegal. Go away. But we don't know that.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly the record industry was, in their mind, had their entire infrastructure, you know, eroded from underneath them overnight. And I certainly, as you said, I talked to a lot of them because, you know, I used Napster, but I understood the legal gray areas. I wasn't, you know, I'd been around enough to understand mm-hmm. that it was very fuzzy. And that I certainly had enormous sympathy for, you know, the record industry that I had grown up with and loved that didn't know what to do with this and was falling apart as a result. So it was important for me to really try to dig into the skin of that and let them communicate that perspective.
Right. Now, as an actor yourself, I mean, you know, if there had been, at the time of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, if there had been a way to download movies and to swap movie files for
yeah.
free, you know, would how might you have felt about that?
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's a hypothetical question.
It's a hypothetical question. I mean, you know, it's then I now start to get into some legal gray areas that might disappoint my financiers. So I'm going to tread carefully. But look, I think there's a real question as to whether this stuff causes promotion or dissolution. And I honestly don't believe we know the answer to that yet. I don't believe we know. I think the Wolverine case was interesting in the movie side where, you know, they really put the hammer to this guy who uploaded a copy of Wolverine. But the most of the statistics showed that it probably did more help to the movie's box office than hurt because mm-hmm. of the free promotion. I'm not saying that I'm a piracy advocate. I don't love the idea of people, you know, stealing stuff. I believe people should pay for stuff, obviously. We all work very hard to make things and it needs to be part of the market. But I think we still live in a gray area in terms of really isolating who really is committing piracy here and who is actually doing more towards promotion and not really siphoning off enough to be of any harm.
Well, and as you say, these are big questions that we still don't really have the answer to. It's only been 10 years since, you know, well, a little more than 10 years now. But, you know, we're talking about technology that in the course of human history is really recent and that is, you know, every time you turn around has like doubled and tripled in size.
Yes.
So the questions are not likely to have easy answers.
Absolutely not. And that's really why I wanted to make the documentary was, you know, I looked around and just felt at least maybe we can just add some small voice to the conversation because I don't think that there are easy answers. I can't sit here and say, you know, I'm with the pirates or I'm with, you know, the record industry or it's that black and white because it isn't. I think that there are a lot of voices in the movie that make it clear, you know, people even surprisingly like Henry Rollins, who can argue very articulately for both sides.
Right.
It's not a black and white issue, without a doubt.
Well, you know, unfortunately for the guys from Napster, a lot of their inability to even get to the Supreme Court comes down to a single email and a single word in that single email where they find
Parker.
It's Parker talking about, you know, keeping their users anonymous as their sharing their files with each other.
Yeah.
And then in parentheses, you know, because it's a lot of pirated material.
Right. Exactly.
And there's that word, pirated. And that becomes the death knell for Napster.
Yes.
To the tune of how much money?
It's I spent a lot of time with people digging. We racked up about $500 million in settlement dollars.
Half a billion. B.
Yeah. Once all the dust, some of this is still going on. There are people that are still being sued and having money yanked out of them, specifically to Napster, not just, you know, RIA, you know, longstanding suits with users for downloading. It was a sinkhole of massive proportions.
Now, you know, as some of us will recall, Napster did try to revive itself as a legal licensing, you know, working with the industry sort of company. What happened to that?
Well, that really had nothing to do with Napster. The name, like Kleenex, was bought out of bankruptcy by another company, and they just used it. Mm. They slapped it on – it still continues to this day to be slapped on. Shows you the strength of the brand onto all kinds of – I mean, I'll be surprised if I don't see a moped company called Napster eventually. It's just – it's sort of, you know, working its way down the chain of corporate branding. But the guys, when they went bankrupt, they were all done.
So where are they now?
Well, you know, they're two very bright, you know, Fanning and Parker, who, you know, were the co-founders are, I mean, they're all doing really well. All the guys are doing really well. They're really smart guys. You know, they were not, they were very, you know, emotionally devastated by the experience. They were not cocky, arrogant anarchists. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think they all spent a lot of time sort of just trying to recover. Took a few years, I think, for all of them. Fanning sold a gaming company to EA for $30 million. Parker has made a couple billion with his association with Facebook, and now he's one of the guys running Spotify with Daniel Ek. So, uh-huh. You know, these guys
when,
are...
When Justin Timberlake portrays you in on screen, you're doing okay.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
so
hopefully.
Sean Parker is the... He's the Justin Timberlake
he
character
is.
In the
in
Facebook
the social
movie,
network.
The social
That's
network.
Correct. Yeah.
So the guys are doing all right. The industry, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, now showing the slightest bit of growth in sales, and it's mainly because of digital sales. And I sort of come back to, you know, what I said at the beginning, which is I find the situation so frustrating that it took more than a decade for the digital side and the industry to learn to work together to where they're actually making it happen now.
Yeah.
Are you frustrated after telling this story?
I mean, I went into it frustrated and I've come out of it frustrated, but I wasn't looking to satisfy my frustration as much as, you know, make other people frustrated. Mm. There you go. There's the name. but, you know, I do think it's, I think as you said, it's an enormous paradigm shift. I don't think we can really underestimate how big these changes are, and they're going to take time. I actually don't believe much is really getting worked out between the digital side and the existing establishment yet at all. I see this as micro steps forward that'll probably still have big steps backwards before the artist is being properly compensated,
right.
Which is really all that matters at the end of the day.
Right. So this is the big deal with the subscription services like Spotify. It's just...
Where's artist development? Where's artist compensation? Those two questions should be at the front of any discussion about anything going forward.
Alex Winter is the director behind the new documentary Downloaded about the history, the rise, and the spectacular fall of the file-sharing site known as Napster. Alex, it raises perhaps more questions than it answers. That's a job well done. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Downloaded premiered at this year's South by Southwest Film Festival, but it opens here in New York on Friday, June 21st. On Monday's Soundcheck, Adam Davidson from NPR's Planet Money podcast joins us to talk about his New York Times story about scalping. It's called How Much Is Michael Bolton Worth to You? And the English electronic musician and producer John Hopkins, he's worked with Brian Eno and the singer known as King Creosote. Now he joins us to perform pieces from his fascinating new solo record, Immunity. And another installment in our series, That Was a Hit? About improbable chart success. We hear the story of Sukiyaki. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday at 9. Till then, check us out online at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer.